You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 22nd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Julian Edgman, professor of urban and environmental policy and planning at Tufts University in Medford. Co-author of Sharing Cities, a case for truly smart and sustainable cities. Also on the program today, Marco Rubio, little Marco, set to make an announcement today. He decides he wants to be a senator again after all. The job that he hated never showed up for. Apparently there's some value in him, at least according to him, in being senator for longer. Meanwhile, Denny Hastert, former Republican Speaker of the House, former Republican impeachment leader, heads to jail for 15 months. It's a bit of a bank shot, but ultimately, for molestation that he committed 40 years ago. New poll says 55% of Bernie voters will vote for Clinton, but only 55%. Dig a little deeper and you realize, people will click on that headline. That's about it. Trump has another lawsuit problem. This one stemming from charges with his buddy Epstein. And a man claims now to have been Omar Mateen's lover. Says that the Orlando attack was about revenge, not ISIS. And what's that? Oh, you got to switch it back. And lastly, French police pleading with French unions to give them a day off. Doesn't look like it's going to happen. All that and more. There's a bill to expand the FBI national security letters. Will not die in the Senate. Will not die. There's still time to deal with that. Head over to EFF. We'll put a link on the blog to that EFF movement. You can check it out. To keep wanting to expand these national security letters of the FBI. We'll get to that a little bit later in the program. A couple of house cleaning notes. On Friday, we are going to be live at 12:30 instead of our normal 12 p.m. time, which means the podcast is probably going to be put out about a half hour later. It is my daughter Mila's graduation from elementary school. And so she wants me to attend. So I said I would. What are you going to do about that? Folks, you know this show is like a, it's like a class, right? I mean, in some ways, I mean, we try and be a little more amusing than your average professor, and you know, I'm not as qualified probably as your average professor. Not probably. I'm not. Let's be honest. But wouldn't it be great to take a class in something that interests you or that you're already really passionate about? Doesn't have to be politics. But of course, you don't have time to sit in a classroom. You got a job. You got kids. You've already graduated college. If you're Matt, you have all sorts of...
Xbox to play.
Xbox to play. But now you have access to thousands of college courses and lectures all in the palm of your hands with the Great Courses Plus. Right now, you can get 1 month free by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/majority. We'll put that on the front page of majority.fm. You'll learn from the world's greatest professors and experts in their field. Experts at National Geographic, the Smithsonian, Ivy League professors. Learn at your own pace, when you want, where you want. You can do it while you're exercising, while you're cooking, cleaning, folding. I'm just going through what my daily life is, except for the exercising part. Commuting. You can binge watch an entire college course over a weekend. No tests, no homework, no schedules to keep. New subjects, lectures, and professors added every month. You can choose from over 7,000 topics. They can be history or science, food and wine. Well, my sister should do that. My sister is, I mean, she's an expert on Italian wines. But maybe she could learn a thing or two about, I don't know, Australian wines. Music and fine arts. Mathematics. Not necessarily a fan of math myself, but you may be. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/majority. Sign up today for your 1 month free trial. 1 month free trial. You could take half a dozen courses in that 1 month. It's a great deal. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/majority. Sign up today. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/majority. So before we go to the professor on these sharing cities, I don't know, maybe I should do this. So I just saw on Twitter, Hayes responding to Tim Carney. Tim Carney is a writer for the Washington Examiner. I used to go on regularly with Tim Carney on, what's that guy's? Dylan Radigan's show. And Tim's a nice guy. I mean, I totally disagree with just about everything that comes out of his mouth. But he's a nice guy. I still enjoy arguing with him. And he's a libertarian. It always made me chuckle because he always had to announce that he was a libertarian before. And we never, you know, it wasn't like we could sit there on the show and get to the sort of really funny stuff, although there was a couple of times. And this is years ago. And sometimes he goes on Hayes. So he tweeted something out. I don't have that set up because I'm like literally primed to respond to this. But he tweeted out where someone had written, like, it really bothers me when Republicans go on TV and say Democrat politician instead of Democratic politician, right? Now, this was a Frank Luntz tested this with focus groups, and it supposedly works because it makes people think of rats instead of, like, a people or something. I don't know why. And Tim Carney wrote back, like, I think this is hilarious that it annoys people so much. And then Hayes wrote back, Carney, I think you'd find it annoying if I just started calling you Jim all the time, particularly on air. But what Carney doesn't realize, and he's going to after I finish this tweet to him right on air, is that this is that feeling that Tim has is what was the seed which sprouted into Donald Trump. That is that whole disposition. No PC, bravado. We're going to be petty, but we're going to make that pettiness so huge, so fantastic. You're going to forget it's petty. We have audio that we're going to play later in the show, probably in the fun half, and I'm going to have to give you, you know, a warning because they're swearing. But like these Trump protesters, and these guys are going, you know, yelling people, F you, to these people that I don't know if they're Latino or not, but they're perceived to be, go eat your effing burritos and this and that. And then one guy who's got a t-shirt with a flag draped around an eagle, just going like, look at this, this is what it's all about. And the guy's like literally pointing to a T-shirt that he bought, you know, for $12. And like, this is what it's all about. Just taking the pettiness and raising it above. So help me phrase this. Tim, your enjoyment of that petty, childish, your enjoyment, I'm just going to keep it like tight. Your enjoyment is the seed, or was the seed, right? Was the seed that blossomed into Donald Trump as the leader of the Republican Party. Now, I wish I had like a strike feature where I could say like Republican Party. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to hashtag Republican. Oh, shoot. Now I want to put LOL because I want to make it like that is. Okay, Tim, your enjoyment, I'm just going to put the equal sign. Equals seed that blossomed into Donald Trump as GOP leader. So I can really put, let's see, your enjoyment grew into, wait, your enjoyment of the seed was the seed, this is really fun for people, that blossomed into Donald Trump as GOP leader.
Yeah, this Sam Tweets feature is going to do fire on YouTube.
Oh, this is going to be crazy. I'm going to put Republican. LOL. LOL. Get it? There we go. All right, there we go, folks. That's how that tweet was born. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Julian Edgeman, who I imagine would be rather embarrassed if he knew that's what I was doing before I brought him on. Professor of Urban and Environmental Policy and Planning on his new book, Sharing Cities. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Julian Edgeman, the author or co-author, I should say, of Sharing Cities, A Case for Truly Smart and Sustainable Cities. He's a professor of urban and environmental policy and planning at Tufts University, among other elements of his bio. Welcome to the program, Julian.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be here.
So let's start with this notion of your notion of the sharing paradigm versus the sharing economy. Because I have to say that, like, you know, I think when people really start to think about this, the notion, just even the term sharing economy becomes sort of a joke, because you start to realize, like, there's really, we're not really sharing with that sharing economy. It's just, we're just, we're still trading money. I mean, talk about the sort of the broader notion of sharing paradigm.
Yeah, it's a great question to open with, Sam. I mean, and this is exactly why we started looking at the book idea. What really was beginning to surprise us and alarm us was that despite the good intentions, perhaps, of setting up a car share or a company like Uber that would kind of share rides, or setting up a company like Airbnb that would rent out rooms in a home, you know, so that you could spend some time with a family. Well, this has all been corrupted and completely changed, and now you've got massive amounts of venture capital behind these companies, which are, you know, economic powerhouses these days. So the original idea of sharing has dropped by the wayside. And what we realized in our research was that although the sharing economy and collaborative consumption, these trendy terms were, you know, were being bandied around, that the city in itself from history was a shared space. Infrastructure, both hard infrastructures and soft infrastructures, public spaces, libraries, schools, hospitals. And we realized that some cities around the world were beginning to see the potential in this notion of sharing as a social, cultural, and political activity rather than a purely economic one. And, you know, we noticed that the cities that were doing this started to see not the economy as driving society, but society driving economic ideas, and the environment was fundamental to the evolution of cities rather than the environment just being a source of resources. So we really began to see that cities should, as perhaps part of their evolution, recapture this idea of the urban commons and the sharing city.
And I should say, you did case studies of six cities, and ranging from San Francisco, San Francisco, Seoul, Copenhagen, Medellin, Amsterdam, and Bengaluru. How much of what we're seeing in the context of these cities is a function of tech or a function of a latent or not latent sort of just, feature, cultural feature of the city? I mean, you know, San Francisco, I think people now perceive it as the sort of high-tech mecca, but, you know, it wasn't that long ago where it was more about, like, the hate, and there was a sort of a more hippie mentality, I guess, associated with San Francisco.
Yeah, it's another great question. I mean, what we've seen, and the case studies are there to illustrate, very different forms of the concept of sharing, and it goes from really San Francisco at one end, which is, you know, a vibrant economy, but it's controversial. It's a commercial sharing economy. It's private sector led. It's fueled by, you know, bundles of venture capital. And it's largely indifferent to what we call communal sharing, which is perhaps better exemplified by somewhere like Medellin in Colombia, where the mayors over the last 20 years have used a philosophy of what they call social urbanism to rebuild an urban commons. They've focused financing funded by the city's public utility into poor neighborhoods, the favelas, the comunas, which are largely on the hillsides. They've built these amazing cable car systems up into the hillsides so that people from the poorest parts of town can get into the central downtown to access the resources of the city. They've built these Parque Biblioteca, these library parks, up in the poorest parts of towns to drive to drive education, learning, and to hopefully as well to drive economic development. So these are two very different models, building the urban commons of Medellin, which, remember, in the 1980s was the cocaine capital of the world. This city has turned itself around through this philosophy of social urbanism. And you contrast that then with the largely unaffordable San Francisco, which has really opted for a very much venture capital-fueled sharing economy. Two contrasts.
I mean, how does a city like Medellin turn itself around in that way? I mean, is it turning around the fate of the city, and there has been a fundamental or that the people have not fundamentally changed? I mean, that is, and I want to get into some of the other cities, but one thing that sort of dogs me here is that, is there necessarily permission to do this or to have this? I mean, where does this come from, this impetus come from in these places? Because so much of what is sold to us, at least in the context of this country, as being sharing is really just sort of a more efficient marketplace. Where does that come from?
Well, you know, this is another great question, and it's one that I talk with my students about a lot. What I'm noticing is places like Seoul in South Korea, where the mayor has led a very strong mayoral vision towards the sharing city, the inclusive city. It's the same in a lot of Latin American cities, including Medellin. Porto Alegre came out with this idea of participatory budgeting, where a certain portion of the city's annual budget is given over to popular mandate as to where the money should be spent. Medellin does the same. My own city, Cambridge, Massachusetts, has given over money, and I participate in saying where a small amount of money from the city's coffers should go. That's a great way of building an urban commons, an idea of people being responsible decision makers within their communities. And of course, once you start allocating resources as a citizen, you're interested in how those resources develop and how the bike lane or the recycling facility or whatever we fund, how does that work? And so you are drawn into a set of decisions. Now, I personally think that it needs visionary mayors. And, you know, I invoke a colleague of mine, Benjamin Barber, here, whose book is When Mayors Rule the World. Cities are, I think, the new mini-states. These are the new focuses of responsibility. You look at something like C40 cities, which is a group of cities looking to lower carbon footprints, set up by Mayor Bloomberg, former Mayor Bloomberg, and former Mayor Livingston in London. Cities are doing more on climate change than nations are, and cities are doing more on lots of things than nations are. And maybe these are the new focuses. Maybe these are the new crypto states that we talk about, where things can get done. And I would absolutely agree with Benjamin Barber that we need a world parliament of mayors, because that's where we can get things done.
I mean, that's interesting, because I'm you know, there's a flip side, right, though, I mean, to a guy like Bloomberg, and there's a flip side to Cambridge, which, you know, still has the sort of vestige of being a, you know, back in the day, it was called the United Republic of Cambridge in Massachusetts, and people, it was you know, sort of one of the most left-leaning cities in the state, and so, you know, they $500,000 is allocated so the people can participate in the budgeting process. But I can also see that, you know, things like the flip side of that is, when I was a kid growing up in Massachusetts, I think it was Proposition 13 or 3 or 1, which basically cut all the funding to my schools because people decided, like, we want to cap our property taxes and we don't want the money spent on the schools. Bloomberg has basically driven out of there's a huge amount of building that's happening in New York City, but it's basically like a gated community on some level. I mean, it's people have been priced out. How do you regulate that?
Yeah, I'm not saying that I agree with everything that Mayor Bloomberg did, for instance. I'm saying, though, that something like C40 Cities, which was set up with two or three other mayors, is a really good idea, a way of bringing cities to a level of responsibility where they can start to seriously influence carbon footprints around the world. And this is a growing network of cities. And I, on the other hand, another thing that I think that Mayor Bloomberg did well was with his transportation commissioner, Janet Sadiq Khan, they democratized Broadway. I mean, Broadway was a traffic-filled street. It's now a people street. It's now a shared space, and it exemplifies this idea of sharing urban infrastructures. So those two things are good. But then, you know, yes, London, New York, a lot of these cities are now gated. But this is not to do with the philosophy of sharing. This is because we've allowed, and in some ways favored foreign finance to come into cities and start doing things which are completely out of the city's control virtually. But that's I think something else other than the locally made decisions about sharing, which is what I my book focuses on.
And let's talk a little bit about Copenhagen. The city is the public realm, and the implications of shared public spaces. I mean, how does that, I guess, promote this concept?
Well, again, when a lot of people think of sharing, they think of the sharing economy. They think of bike shares, they think of car shares, Zipcar, etc. Copenhagen has done a lot through its planning, and it was the first city back in the early 60s to go on an extensive pedestrianization of the urban core. And what the Danes have done through their very sort of Scandinavian philosophy is very incremental. I remember one of the mayors saying, don't do too much, just do a little bit every year, a little bit more pedestrianization, a little bit more of making parks, a little bit more. So the Danes have had a very progressive movement for the last 50 years towards opening up spaces that are welcoming of immigrants. So in one part of the city, the district called Norrebro, which is a very immigrants, migrants, low-income minority part of the city, they've created a space that is, I think, fabulous. It has artifacts from every community that is represented locally. So you've got these artifacts from Ghana or from Russia or from Mexico or from Britain. And in many ways, it's just a statement of, you are present in our country. This is a space, a shared space, a culturally inclusive space. So the Danes have been very intentional, I think, about creating spaces which are more culturally inclusive. One thing I also noticed when I was in Copenhagen, the last couple of times I've been there, is the cyclists. One thing, they go very fast and you get knocked over by a cyclist if you're not careful. But number two, these are immigrants. They are pregnant women. They are older people. Cycling cuts across modern, multicultural or intercultural Danish society. It's not an exclusive thing like we've found it to be more in the United States. So the Danes are doing something about sharing space, whether that's biking infrastructure, whether it's parks, whether it's pedestrian alleys and streets. That's what we were saying about Copenhagen. So Copenhagen has, in a sense, co-produced inclusive space, and that is sharing.
When you take a look at, let's say, like the bike sharing that we have in New York, I don't know if you have it in Boston per se, but I mean, give me a sense of like how, what the contrast would be.
Okay, well, I was asked by Hubway, which is the Boston bike share organization. I was asked by a member of their workforce a couple of questions, one of which was, so Julian, we've been operating this bike share scheme for 2 years in Boston now. We are wildly successful beyond our dreams, but we've noticed there are very few people of color and very few people from low-income groups on our bikes. What could we do? And I said, well, number one question is, on what are you basing your success if you haven't got buy-in from a large proportion of the community? And sheepishly, she agreed that this was not good. And I said, well, look, did you involve anybody from low-income or minority groups in figuring out the program, the stations, how the scheme works? And she said, no. And I said, well, maybe that's a problem. Maybe you, white, privileged people, sat down and thought about a bike scheme that fits white, privileged people. And that's what you have, a bike scheme that fits white, privileged people. All of the bike stations, or most of them at that time, were in very middle-class areas. And in any case, the idea comes to me, what would a bike share scheme look like if it were based around the needs of low-income and minority groups? I don't think it would look like the schemes that we have at the moment, because the schemes that we have at the moment, and New York is no different to Boston or to London, the schemes are for tourists and for commuters. And many people on low incomes are neither tourists nor commuters. So, again, this brings us to another point in the book where we say that one thing that cities can do, which commercial companies can't do in terms of sharing, cities could look to use regulation and enable sharing schemes to be built on equity and social justice. And in this way, we might start to then get bigger buy-in to some of these sharing schemes where, at the moment, they're really just sharing among people who have a lot of resources anyway.
I mean, that story is fascinating for a number of reasons. One, like that problem of measuring success, but leaving out a significant portion of the population's participation and still finding success. I mean, I think that dynamic explains a huge a dynamic that's taking place in the country, right? I mean, we see that split just in terms of the way that people measure the economy, broadly speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this speaks to even more why we feel that if we get sharing cities right, we can decrease inequality, increase social capital, and decrease resource use. That's because otherwise we are just going to pull apart. We are going to self-sort into our little groups, as we are doing, aided, I might say, very well by certain politicians, aspiring presidential candidates who really do want division. The sharing city is about breaking down these barriers. It's about stopping us self-sorting. It's about creating opportunities, spaces of encounter between people of different groupings, origins, ages, abilities, and disabilities. So it's in a sense, it's about a vision of an American city or a British city or a city anywhere in the world, which really co-creates an urban commons where all can thrive and all can find a place to thrive. And it's about giving cities a greater role in using their current regulatory permitting, licensing, zoning regulations to do this. Now, let me give you one very good, well, give you an example. Airbnb. It's a good idea, but if you let it go unregulated, unscrupulous landlords are buying up properties and renting them out through Airbnb, making huge amounts of money, kicking up rental prices, and decreasing the stock available for rentals. That's not good. That will change neighborhoods, and it will decrease affordability. What Amsterdam has done, what Berlin has done, what the country of Iceland is going to do, is to strongly regulate Airbnb so that, yes, people can make a few dollars on a few rooms in their house, but that they can't change neighborhoods or decrease affordability by renting out whole places. So Berlin now will not allow you to rent out your whole house. You can only rent out a room or two. Amsterdam has a 60-day maximum per year rental. Iceland is looking to regulate because it worries about the neighborhood characters of Reykjavik being changed. changed if Airbnb goes unregulated. This is the point we're making, that cities have a role in regulating this economy. It can be made to work for a lot of people, but only if it's regulated properly. And we see in places like San Francisco, one of the problems where there is virtually no regulation and a very unaffordable housing market.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is there's a big dynamic with that, I think, happening also in Brooklyn, frankly, where there's a huge number of housing units that have been taken off the market so that they can be rented out short term. People can make more money that way off them. And there's no response. So how would you do that within the context? I mean, where have people regulated Uber? Is it just that they have to be licensed, or there's a certain amount of what is the analog to something like Uber?
Well, the city of Seoul in South Korea has banned Uber and has enabled its own car sharing service. So cities like Seoul are taking another tack and sort of banning entirely Uber. Other cities are trying regulatory approaches. I think the bottom line is there is space for everybody. I have to say, I'm going to be using Airbnb this summer. I've booked a place, and I do use Uber. And in some in some cases, I look with pity at some of the people getting into some of the taxis in Central Square here in Cambridge because they are dirty. A lot of the taxi drivers are not polite. They talk on their phones all the time. The cars smell of cigarette smoke. You know, these disruptors like Uber, we need them. We need them to jog out of their complacency certain practices that have become endemic. And, you know, I'd like to see taxis start to utilize some of the technologies that Uber and others use. I just want to go back to a point that you made about smart cities, because take aim at smart cities, and I want to give you an example. What we're saying is sharing cities are cities where people are enabled, they have their capacity developed such that they can use technologies. One thing that worries us is that some cities are labeling themselves smart cities and purely becoming loaded technologically, so that, you know, for instance, in Copenhagen, you can have this thing called the green wave, which is if you cycle at 20 kilometers per hour on certain cycle routes into town, you will not see a red light because the technology enables green lights to go all along from the outskirts right into the downtown area of the city. That's a great use of technology in support of humans. But there are certain cities, and I don't want to mention names, where cities have teamed up with the app called Waze, W-A-Z-E. Mm-hmm. Waze helps people find traffic shortcuts around congestion, roadworks, etc. Great, you would think. But I've got a lot of evidence that this Waze app is merely stalling discussions around infrastructure spending.
Right.
That's not smart. So if mayors start to use apps as saviors and thinking that they're going to get away from hard questions about infrastructure spending or traffic reduction or increases in buses and subway funding, that's not smart. Okay, I believe in apps like Waze, but only if they accompany solid discussions around infrastructure spending, around public transit. Do you see my point there?
Yeah.
Smart and sharing are not the same. I want to see smart cities, but I also want to see them cities where there is a spend on infrastructure and public resources.
Yeah, I mean, I specifically remember hearing that in the I guess it was last year, in the massive snowstorm that hit up in Massachusetts. I still have family in Worcester, so I would hear quite a bit about this, and the idea that, you know, Waze was going to replace the idea of like figuring out how to remove snow is a problem. And in some ways, that, right, that efficiency is a punt in some way, right? It's an easy way for politicians to ignore real, legitimate, long-term planning and infrastructure needs.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the city in question was Boston. And the mayor got into this deal with Waze precisely at that time, when basically roads were at about 20%, 30% capacity because of the snowbanks. And so, yes, it was crisis-driven smart city technology, which then, you know, I think stopped conversations around infrastructure spending.
Right.
So, again, I think you know, we as the public need to hold mayors to account, aside from the fact that, you know, Google, who own Waze, get data on, I think, 500,000 drivers a day in the greater Boston region. That doesn't come without some thinking on my behalf as to what is going to be, what that data is going to be used for. Have we asked questions about that? Is it going to be used altruistically to help plan for more road space? Because we don't need more road space. We need less road space. We need more spending on public transit. That's what you know is a kind of a feature of a shared city.
What do you think that they would use that for? I mean, would it be? I mean, is this stuff that they're trying to? I mean, I know that there's probably an enormous amount of data that Google just feels like we're going to need it someday. But what do you think that they contemplate the use of that data?
Well, you know, as I understand it, that data is going to be, quote, made available to the city's traffic management authorities. Now, in a tweet a few months ago, I said, why are we having traffic management? Why don't we have a traffic reduction authority? You know, traffic management says, hey, how do we manage the current amount of traffic we have in our city? Traffic reduction says, how can we reduce the amount of traffic coming into our city? So I'd like to see the paradigm shift from traffic management, which is very status quo and what do we do with what we have, to traffic reduction, which says we could do with less traffic in our cities. How do we do that? And I'm not sure that thinking has permeated Boston City Council yet, and I'd like to see it happen.
Right, and I would imagine it's probably, although I don't know, maybe Google is antithetical to Google's long-term interests, right? I mean, anything that it seems to me is something that is that becomes more a function of the common good is in some respects long-term, broadly speaking, contrary to the interests of a private corporation, which is going to try and sell additional products, right? I mean, like, once you have the subway system and it becomes ubiquitous, it cuts down on the need for, you know, broad solutions like driverless cars, let's say, or am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a real gray area here with, you know, a huge corporation supposedly cooperating with the city. Their goals are different. And, you know, what we're sort of trying to say in the book is that, you know, commercial goals of a company are very different to what might be seen as the cultural goals of a city in inculcating this idea of sharing and, you know, being responsible about public space. The city's goals, I think, are as much political as they are economic. And I think that, you know, many cities need to start rethinking this idea of the urban commons. How can they increase it? Again, one approach that I think is very easily doable, it's got very high PR value and can have very high buy-in, is participatory budgeting. Mm. And again, you know, in Cambridge and in many other cities around the country and in many other cities around the world, a lot of people are assisting in decision-making about how money should be spent. And the projects that are up for votes are, again, suggested by people in the community. The projects themselves are then voted on. In places like Medellin, that's, participatory budgeting doesn't end there. What happens then is people have a say in how the facilities that are voted on, how they are built, how they are designed. So Medellin goes the whole hog. And again, it's this idea of co-production, co-producing the urban commons. What does our city look like? How does the city engage in a debate, a process where people are involved more intimately in the management of those shared spaces of the city? That's got to be the way to go forward. And it's a way that can bring in people, irrespective of socioeconomic groups, irrespective of culture or countries of origin or religion. It's a great way, I think, to start to build notions of shared opportunity and shared futures.
Julian Edgman, professor of urban and environmental policy and planning at Tufts, co-author of Sharing Cities, A Case for Truly Smart and Sustainable Cities. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam, for letting me on your show.
And, of course, we will post that a link to Sharing Cities at majority.fm. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program with a reminder. This show exists by the grace of you. It's all part of our sharing economy. You got to press that button because I can hear you scratch your cheek. Oh, God, we broke another one. You can become a member of the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com, ladies and gentlemen. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Also, you can buy from jet.com at majorityreportkickback.com. And take a quick break. Be right back after this. 646-257-3920.